as I said I would do this afternoon when we were at Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's temple, wanted to dedicate this evening for some of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's teachings, because we discussed a little bit of his pastimes. The altar where the deities are is right where the house of Bhaktivinoda Thakur was, or at least part of the house, and where the murti of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur presently is the precise location where he was born, in the house of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, by Bhaktisiddhanta's arrangement. He wrote a letter to one householder who was his disciple who wanted to worship his picture. And Bhaktisiddhanta wrote back in quite strong language not to do that. He wrote, "It is better that my picture not be kept in devotees' homes. We should always remember that the desire for honor and prestige is like pig stool. After my passing away, these may be required. If worship of such symbols is begun in my living presence, it will be my downfall." Specifically, he was addressing desire for honor and prestige. I'm going to go through, these are largely quotes that devotees that have read, I haven't read, Bhakti Vikash Maharaj's book on the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. You know, that 3-volume book that's that thick. So this is just some quotes from there. The first one I'm going to read is in relation to the nomenclature. Prabhupada used Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I was under the impression that Prabhupada coined the phrase, but here it's described that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used that phrase, Godhead. He used it specifically explicitly and purposefully to distinguish the concept of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead from the Christian concept of God. Bhaktisiddhanta wrote, "The personality of Godhead distinguishes from the Christian concept of God. The Christian idea of God as the creator of a world meant for enjoyment of its inhabitants is a very weak conception. He considered Christianity merely hazy gratitude toward a vaguely defined cosmic order supplier." Somebody just sent me another. Oh no, it's here also. The Seer and the Seen. Also from this writing. Dravya and Vrishta. Drashta. is the seer, and drishya is the seen. So I'll read the quote at the bottom where Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said the litmus test for one's progress in Krishna consciousness is making this distinction properly. The extent to which individuals, religions, or sampradayas recognized, acquiesced to, and lived by the proper understanding of the living entity in relation to God was, in Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's estimation, litmus test of their genuineness, sincerity, and advancement in bhakti. So, rather than reading it in his high language, the simple explanation is egocentric versus God-centric. Egocentric is, I am the seer, and everything else in my purview is seen by me. I'm at the center, and everything else around me is what I see. That's mundane consciousness. So, even the idea of darshan of the deity is of a similar connotation. Rather, he recommends that one should understand that God is the seer and we are to be seen. He is the enjoyer and we are to be enjoyed. Oh. The enjoyers of this world think themselves seers. And the renunciates encounter to the bitterness they have experienced in the world, ultimately conclude that the seer and the enjoyer are nirvishesh, devoid of characteristics. But although it is inauspicious for the jiva to think of himself as the enjoyer and seer, it is even more inauspicious for the jiva to attempt suicide by killing the enjoyer and seer, thinking them to be a hangman's rope around the neck. The best path is to see oneself as the object of enjoyment of and the object of seeing by the supreme enjoyer and seer. Hiranyakashipu thought he was the seer of the pillar in the hall and desires to observe the existence of Vishnu or to measure Vishnu, and adjusting himself, the enjoyer perceived Prahlad as his son, the object of his enjoyment. But the Lord of inconceivable powers revealed his inconceivable eternal form to Hiranyakashipu and destroyed that seer, and was very merciful to Prahlad, who regarded himself as the object to be seen or enjoyed by Vishnu. I remember after I became a devotee and I was visiting my parents, we had a little, I deliberately avoided getting into discussions because I knew where it would go. Discussions about, you know, what's the Krishna conscious view on things. So I remember that conversation, visiting my parents' home, and, you know, as a young devotee, being respectful to my parents, because I just didn't want to, like, any verbal thing going on, altercation. My parents asked a question about vegetarianism. Why was I vegetarian? And I gave, you know, some of the standard reasons, and then they gave some of the standard Christian reasons. Why is it wrong? God gave us this world to enjoy. God gave man dominion over animals. So, why not be the enjoyer? God gave it to us to enjoy. The answer I gave they didn't like. The answer that I gave was, when I was small, you had dominion over me. And I didn't even get to finish the rest of the sentence. But that didn't mean, and my mother cried and got up and ran out of the room. My father said, "Why are you making your mother cry?" She's just answering her question about dominion and, you know. And that's what Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur is saying is not just armchair, it's the ideology. It's religious to be the enjoyer of the facilities that God has given. God is loving. God is great. He's created this place for us to enjoy. Dig in. Enjoy prosperously. Be a lover of God and enjoy that which God has given. Therefore, Bhaktisiddhanta's language hazy gratitude towards a vaguely defined cosmic order supplier, God. So he didn't want to use that term in English. He wanted a more appropriate term. So he then explained that in Christian mysticism, Godhead was generally, quote unquote, was generally taken to denote the ineffable, that essence of God which you can't explain in words. Again, a Bhaktisiddhanta dictionary term, hypostasis, which means the essence or the substance underlying reality. So Godhead indicates, out of this vague, hazy conception of a cosmic order supplier, there's this essence. And the essence is the fountainhead of all things. And in fact, he is, as the source, he's the proprietor. As the proprietor, he's the enjoyer, and all the other proper scriptural understandings of the position of God. That means we're the servant in the kingdom of God. And that's what we do. And that's our happiness, is being the servant in the kingdom of God. Then another paragraph expresses, in an age where totalitarianism was widespread yet much despised and feared, this is in the, you know, World War I and post-World War I leading into World War II era, where totalitarianism was very prevalent and very much despised and feared. Bhaktisiddhanta went right in there and spent, that's God. Sri Krishna is the supreme and transcendental despot. Like, you know, like tyrant. That's what despot means. He's got total control, and that's it, Bubba. There's nobody else that has anything else to say. Like, so, you know, there's no democracy, forget it. He's it. And a spiritual autocrat. Another, as he wrote in the presentation of Sri Brahma Samhita, a transcendental autocrat who is forever inviting the conditioned souls to enjoy with him in a loving mood. He would quote the legalism, quote, all rights reserved. All rights reserved. Does that mean something to people that know about legal jargon? All rights reserved. Okay. All rights reserved. So somebody produces a product, they patent it, and all rights reserved. If you want to use this product, you got to come to me. because if by legal right, all rights reserved, you got to come to me and ask permission. And if you don't, you're in trouble. You're breaking the law. And he's saying that's Krishna's position. And it's unchangeable. He's the unchangeable overlord, an absolute enjoyer, and that no one can independently claim any rights or privileges without his sanction. For everything depends on his sweet will. And he is not answerable to anyone. Whoa, absolute authority. There's that, what's that phrase? Absolute power leads to absolute something. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, Krishna has absolute power. Absolute authority. And uncorruptible. Not answerable to anybody at the same time. Nobody can check him. Here's some nice quotes on chanting. We've been doing a little Harinam. So here's some out of, you know, chapters worth of quotes. By service to the holy name, we do not mean just chanting the name. It includes other duties also. By serving the holy name with body, mind, and soul, the direction of that service spontaneously manifests in the chanter's heart, like the sun in the clear sky. Another. Unless accompanied by shravana, then the attempts to perform kirtana must be material. Repeated hearing gives rise to kirtan and smaran. By kirtana, one begins to perform. By hearing kirtana, one begins to perform kirtana, and from performing kirtana, smarana of Harikatha awakens. Another. The name of the Lord and the Lord himself are not two separate entities, but one. When the sound of the holy name passes over the lips, the conditioned sense of hearing and the conditioned consciousness initially process the sound as if it were material, and that is how it is perceived. As a result, only the external ear hears it. Since the other senses and the mind, which is the collector of sensory experience, are envious of the ear, which they consider to be an equal partner, the result is that such chanting does not affect the cleansing of anartas. Paragraph. We do not have the capacity even to theoretically know that the name and the Lord of the name are one. Yet, just as piercing of the ear is one of the Vedic rites for a young child, when our spiritual ear is pierced by the holy name, the other senses give up their envy of the auditory sense. They no longer quibble with the ear, which alone can perceive transcendental sound. Then the flood of prema pours forth from all the spiritual senses and cleanses away the contaminants of opposition and malice. Thereafter, the Lord's beautiful form, qualities, associates, and pastimes are revealed in the name himself, with a capital H, and experienced by the chanter as something quite distant from his previous experiences in the mundane world. Then, the kinds of worries and distractions of the mind that are typical of the conditioned living being cannot remain. Therefore, we should constantly pray to the holy name for his mercy. Here's a story that Bhaktisiddhanta told, and Bhaktisiddhanta in the assembly when he was telling the story said he heard it from Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj, who heard the story from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And it's a dreamlike state where Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave a Bhagavad Gita class to the demigods. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in a dreamlike state, happened to enter into the court of Yamaraj, where an assembly had been convened to discuss a question concerning two verses of Bhagavad Gita. 930, 931. The Apichet Siddharacharo verse and Chipram Bhavati Dharmatma. I won't read the translation first. I'll go to what their question was and then I'll go back and read the translation. So the persons in the assembly, Yamaraj, one of the 12 Mahajans, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Narada, and principal demigods, were all amongst the 12 Mahajans, and many other exalted persons were present, but they couldn't reach a conclusion on the following doubt. That the second part, that's 931, says, he quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. So the question is, if the one who's engaged in undeviated devotional service quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace, means it's not inherent peace and righteousness are not inherent in bhakti, but they're a byproduct of bhakti. I'll read the translation, and having heard that background, let's see if you can catch what their question is. Here's the translation. Even if one is most abominably behaved, if he is undeviatingly engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered a sadhu because he is properly situated in his determination. Right? When apichat sudharashiro bhajate mam ananyabhak. Bhajate mam ananyabhak. So undivided in devotional service, such a person does something abominable. Sadhur eva samantavya. Krishna says, I consider that person to be saintly because he is rightly situated in his determination. That's clear. The next verse is, he quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. So the doubt is, wait a minute. Here's this undeviatingly engaged bhakta, and by doing so, over a period of time, eventually he becomes righteous and eventually attains lasting peace. Which means righteousness and lasting peace are not part of bhakti. It's a result over prolonged unalloyed bhakti. It would seem like that. So it's a means to achieve those ends. So that was what the discussion was. Seeing Bhaktivinoda Thakur arrive there, all the demigods arose from their seats as a gesture of respect and then presented their topic of discussion to him. Bhaktivinoda Thakur settled the issue by explaining that in this context the pronoun saha or he refers not to the sadhu who is engaged in devotional service in that way, undeviatingly engaged in devotional service, but it refers to the one who is observing the sadhu, who is undeviatingly engaged and does some very bad activity. That person, if he sees, as Krishna sees that sadhu, he will eventually attain righteousness and lasting peace. Saha, he refers not to the sadhu, but to the one who, not being bewildered by the apparently abominable acts of the surrendered devotee, still considers that devotee to be a sadhu. He who so considers quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. Moreover, by not attempting to impose standards of worldly morality upon a sadhu, he himself soon becomes a sadhu. Upon hearing this conclusive elucidation, the demigods offered obeisances to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. End of story. Got it? Any questions on that little story? Clear? Nice, huh? Bhaktivinoda Thakur had a dream that he told Gaurakishore and Gaurakishore told Bhaktisiddhanta. Bhaktisiddhanta told his disciples, and I'm sharing that with you. Here's some strong chants. Bhaktisiddhanta's description of humility. If I proclaim myself superior to others, no one will listen to me. They will slap me in the face and knock me off my pedestal. If I am not predisposed to respect others, then I should not tell them about the Supreme Lord. If the only goal of my life is to serve the Lord, then I should not humiliate or disrespect anyone. If the world belongs to the Lord, then I should know my relationship to His world. The transcendental conception of thinking, quote, I am the dust at the lotus feet of my spiritual master, I am the servant of Guru and Krishna, is what is meant by trinadapi suni chena, becoming lower than grass. Three things: jivadaya, or you can write them down, compassion to all living entities. These are Lord Chaitanya's teachings. Jivadaya, compassion to all jivas. Nama ruchi, taste for the holy names. And Vaishnava seva. These are Mahaprabhu's three teachings. The meaning of trinadapi suni chena is not disingenuous, merely flaunting a show of humility. It means actual eligibility for kirtan by namaruchi and considering oneself a servant of the holy name. Service is the gateway to namaruchi. Service to Guru and Vaishnavas is trinadapi suni chena. We should not become subordinate, nichita, to non-devotees, but to devotees from whom we should beg mercy and show respect. The Mahajans instructed us not to display humility before everyone. Then he says it the other way around, to show humility towards envious atheists like Ravana and the pretentious Brahmana is not Vaishnav Seva or Trinadapi Suni Chena. If we transgress this instruction, we will never become qualified to chant the holy name or attain Namaruchi. Rather, our actions will result in becoming envious of others. Far out. Ram Bhakta Hanuman's burning of Lanka is real Trinadapi Suni Chena. And he didn't act out of envy or enmity. He was teaching them a lesson. And acting in a mood of service to Ram. Ram will soon come and destroy your whole kingdom. here's some instruction that he gave at one of the Gaudiya Math, the temple. So this is specifically directed to his brahmachari preachers to go door to door, but it's relevant also for anyone who wants to become purified. I think we all want to become purified. So the act of preaching Krishna consciousness is purifying. It helps one to become purified. He writes, or he's being quoted, "The Math is the center of Hari Kirtan, and Hari Kirtan is life and consciousness. To make sure that there is no place for sloth, bad conduct, trivial thought, gossip, or vulgar desire at the mat, you must go door to door, where your Hari Kirtan will be tested by the public. They will think," and he lists many bad things, "they will think they are the givers and you are the receivers of alms," in other words, that their status is higher than yours. "And they will criticize you in many ways, considering you objects of their mercy. Perhaps, also, some of them will be ready to kick you out. Then, on one hand, you will be able to become trinadapisunichena and manada, respectful to others. And on the other hand, you will take sincere care to make your lives and characters pure and exemplary. Besides, it will be beneficial for you that as you correct the mistakes of common people by citing the messages of Sadhu Shastra and Guru, you yourselves will not commit those same mistakes." Which is true. When you are in a preaching situation, at least a conscientious devotee is considering, I have to be a proper representative because the whole of Krishna Bhakti is being judged by my little example. Although people aren't sampling the whole of Krishna Bhakti, they're only experiencing you. But your character, your qualities, your manner of speech, besides the particular message you deliver, people are evaluating the whole of Krishna Bhakti. "Do not be upset if anyone criticizes you personally, but your Guru Varga, the Shastra, and the Mahajans are completely faultless, supremely liberated, and eternal associates of the Lord. And by speaking the actual truth, you should correct anyone who criticizes them," not you, but criticizes Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. "By doing so, both yourselves and the foolish criticizers will gain topmost auspiciousness. You may cultivate unenthusiasm for door-to-door bhikshu, and while still beset with anarthas, indulging in slothfulness on the plea of trying to avoid others' criticism and considering nirjan bhajan as one's best interest, but in so doing, your character will not become corrected, nor will you be able to attain the life of actual devotional practice. I will never give you the opportunity to become deceitful on the path of devotion by your absconding to a reclusive residence where no one will hear your words or even see you, and your heart will thus remain undisciplined. You are my dear friends. You may fall into difficulty. You may gain temporary honor from the public, or temporarily become the object of their blasphemy, which you find unpleasant and intolerable, and thus desire to give up the path of satisfying Bhagavan's senses to engage in satisfying those of the public and of oneself. But I will not allow this to happen to you." Thank you. very interesting perspective on preaching. Here's a few quotes on deity worship. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati instructed his disciples to perform archana in a simple, abbreviated manner as an aid to shravana and kirtana, the principal items of bhajan, asserting that pretensions of deity worship without hearing Harikatha is merely idol worship. Yet he did not consider archana inconsequential or irrelevant. He wanted that it be conducted tastefully and with care. Very succinct, isn't it? Primary is hearing and chanting. Deity worship helps hearing and chanting. Prabhupada's way of seeing these two paths, Panchita Trika Vidhi and Bhagavad Vidhi. Of the two, the hearing and chanting portion is most important. Deity worship is there to assist it. It should be done tastefully and with care. But there's a tendency for those who engage in deity worship to kind of get carried away and spend inordinate amount of time, thus reducing their hearing and chanting. And Bhaktisiddhanta didn't approve of that. Deity worship should be performed simply as an aid to shravana and kirtana. One night a pujari at one of the Gaudiya Maths forgot to put up the deity's mosquito nets. Normally Bhaktisiddhanta never checked to see if this had been done. Nor, on this occasion, had anyone informed him of the oversight. Yet the next morning, before Mangal Arati, he asked the pujari if he had forgotten to set up the deity's mosquito net. When the pujari admitted his fault, Bhaktisiddhanta said, "Krishna did not sleep last night. You have erred. You fixed the net for yourself, but not for Krishna. Why?" And in the scheduled lecture that morning, he stressed seriousness of service to the deity form of the Lord. Now here's for those of you that are involved with temple deity worship or one day will be involved with temple deity worship. Listen carefully to this one. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur attributed problematic events in any math, any temple, to offenses in deity worship. Whenever there were occurrences such as theft or severe illness of himself or other temple residents, he especially warned his disciples not to incur offenses against the deity. On the last day of the theistic exhibition of Sri Chaitanya Math in 1930, powerful winds tore apart the structures housing the displays, hurling tin sheets into the air, one of which damaged the dome over the deity of Ramanujacharya adjoining the main temple. Those of you that have been there, the main temple and the four corners, they have the four acharyas. That was also at the temple today, because that was one of the pillars of Bhaktisiddhanta's preaching, is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu united. He drew from and united the four sampradayas' teachings. It landed right on top of Ramanujacharya's murti and broke the roof. So Bhaktisiddhanta said, this must be due to some deviation in the deity worship. So they did a big investigation to find out what was the deviation in the deity worship. And they found out that there was a pujari who had written a love letter to a girl in the deity room. Now, having been involved in Hare Krishna movement for a number of years now, I can say in different situations, in different places, what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said is true, and the converse is also true. And Prabhupada said the same thing. That is, when the deity worship goes on very nicely, the whole congregation and devotee community benefits, and the converse is there. If there are deviations or impurities in the manner of deity worship, the whole community and congregation suffers. So it's very nice to have deities, but it's essential when you have deities to care for the deity properly. And when you do, everyone benefits, and if you don't, everyone suffers. And with some temple-wide calamity, crisis, or illness, or theft, or something, some problem, big problem, stems from some discrepancy in deity worship, some offense to the deity. Okay, here's another very nice topic, prasadam. Here's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. This is kind of intelligible. The language is not too high. His explanation of Mahaprasadam. A person whose body and mind have been accepted by the Lord is privileged to approach him with offerings of food and drink. The Lord is pleased to accept food offered by such persons. By his acceptance, the food is spiritualized in the same way that the body and mind are spiritualized by dedication to the Lord. This dedication of all food to the Lord is true renunciation of all material foodstuffs. Foods accepted by the Lord are spiritualized and changed into Mahaprasad, or, quote, the great blessing. The sadhu accepts Mahaprasad not for the purpose of appeasing hunger, nor for acquiring bodily strength, nor for any other worldly purpose, but with the objective to thereby enable, to thereby be enabled to avoid the traps laid for him. Sensuous temptations of all kinds, including that of eating, during his sojourn in this sphere. By honoring Mahaprasad in that spirit, he obtains the inclination for devotional service to the Lord. Therefore, honoring Mahaprasad is different from eating, although to the uninitiated, both may seem identical. The external form appears to remain the same, while the nature of the activity is fundamentally changed. The result is that, whereas sensuous inclinations are strengthened by mere eating, gluttony and its attendant vices are radically cured by honoring Mahaprasad. Continues. Mahaprasad literally means the great favor, quote unquote. The beneficial result for the soul by honoring Mahaprasad is also available to the conditioned soul. The Lord does not accept food offered by the conditioned soul, but if the conditioned soul honors Mahaprasad, his self is benefited. Food offered by sadhus to the Lord is fundamentally different from ordinary food. To take ordinary food is harmful for the soul, yet by honoring Mahaprasad, not only is the soul saved from the bad effect of eating, but it is positively benefited by obtaining the inclination for spiritual service. Therefore, the Shastras enjoin us to give up eating and to honor Mahaprasad. If the palate is conquered every other sense is conquered. We can never be freed from the attraction of sensuous temptations until we altogether renounce eating and learn to honor Mahaprasad. We don't have to just like stop eating, but stop eating anything other than prasadam. By honoring Mahaprasada, our sensuousness diminishes and ultimately disappears. Only then may we understand the real meaning of the shastras. There's more to this, but I'm inclined to narrate it. A very nice Ramanujacharya story about Mahaprasadam. It's a little intricate. See if I can recall everything correctly. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, along with his associates, decided he wanted to visit Tirupati from Sri Rangam. So in the course of going from Sri Rangam to Tirupati, he was stopping at a few places where he had disciples. And one of the places that he stopped, he had two disciples. One was a very wealthy, aristocratic gentleman, extremely wealthy, and another was a very, very simple couple that had next to nothing. So not because he was traveling with a group, not wanting to impose on the simple couple, he thought, probably it will be best if I stay at the home of this other individual, one that can maintain our party for the night. So he sent two of the party's members ahead to inform this disciple that he would be coming in the evening hour, and if it would be all right, could he make some arrangements for the devotees to stay there for the evening. Immediately the disciple was so happy. Ramanujacharya is coming to stay at our home. How fortunate. And because he was very wealthy, he had so many attendant people to make decorations and invite guests and prepare prasadam and so many things. Just like absorbed and absorbed and absorbed and absorbed and so excited. And in the course of all of that, he didn't at all attend to the two devotees of Ramanujacharya who had come, not even proper reception, just like went in this explosion of enthusiasm to receive Ramanujacharya. So they came back to Ramanujacharya's place, where he was, their camp where they were staying, and said, so we've duly informed your disciple, and he's making all arrangements, and he's expecting us to come in the evening, as he's inviting many guests to also take your darshan. But Ramanujacharya's interest was not what arrangement he was making for him and his group. He said, how were you received? He said, well, to be honest, he didn't even give us a place to sit, and no water even, and we were neglected. But he was very excited to make arrangements for you and all the devotees to come. And Ramanujacharya said, anyone who cannot respect my devotee, I don't want to even see that person or go to that place. We'll go to the other family's home. So, unsuspecting, no prior announcement, Ramanujacharya and his whole group came to the home of this very simple couple, husband and wife, and they were so poor that the husband had to each day go begging. They were Brahmins, and whatever it was that he would receive as alms, that he would use to take care of the necessities of he and his wife. So he was he was out of the home at the time. And his wife was there to receive Ramanujacharya and all the devotees, and in their very simple, humble home, she invited them to sit and brought them water and kind words, and was in big anxiety. How am I going to take care of these guests? So something very similar to, you know, when Durvas Muni showed up with the house of the place of the Pandavas in the forest, and Draupadi had already emptied out the last of her pot, and it was there's nothing. So she said, Ramanuja, you can go ahead and take your bath in the nearby river, and I'll see what I can do to prepare a nice meal for you. And she was in big anxiety. And the big anxiety was, we have nothing. She went to the storage room, and there was nothing. It wasn't even poor quality rice. There wasn't even, you know, stale vegetables. There was nothing. And then the thought came to her mind that there is one very lusty business person, very wealthy business person in our village, and he has been continuously sending messages to engage me in his enjoyments, and he would reciprocate with some wealth. And, you know, it's such a disgusting personality. I've just avoided this individual like poison. But in this circumstance, I don't know what else to do. So she went to the businessman and stated, I'm ready to submit to you this evening, but I have one condition. I have some guests that have come to my home, and I need supplies to take care of their necessities. You take me, you make those arrangements, and I will come to you this evening. We'll satisfy your desires. So he was very enthusiastic. Oh yes, the best of everything. And made all arrangements, and vegetables and rice and milk and all ingredients, all types of grains and ghee and you name it, he sent it. And she prepared a very wonderful feast. And when Ramanujacharya and his company were honoring the feast, her husband came home and looked and saw what was going on, and Ramanujacharya and paid his obeisances and received everyone very warmly. And after all of that was done, he pulled his wife to the side and said, what happened here? How has this come to be? And she looked down at the ground and said, this is what happened, and I didn't know what else to do. And he was so happy. He said, You're such a qualified wife. You're all in all is our spiritual master. And even such a horrible thing as this, simply whatever it takes to please and serve the spiritual master. So they went and told Ramanujacharya how it came to be that they had a nice feast. Ramanujacharya wasn't so happy that the price of the feast was her purity. So he said, you go with your wife to his home and take this Mahaprasadam. He took the Mahaprasad from his own plate and gave it to his wife and said, you deliver us to this man. So the husband waited outside, and the wife came in, as promised, in the evening hour, came and brought the Mahaprasad, came to visit his home. He closed the door, took the Mahaprasad, and as he was eating the Mahaprasad, all of the lusted desires in his heart just vanished. And he asked, who prepared this food? It's so transforming, it's so wonderful. And she said, it's the Mahaprasad of my Guru Maharaj, Ramanujacharya. Oh, Ramanujacharya is your spiritual master, and it's he for whom you wanted to make all these ingredients. Oh, I'm such a sinful, wretched person. He pleaded with her, please take me to see him. I want to beg his forgiveness for this sinful deed that I was planning to do, and all my sinful qualities. And he came and surrendered at the lotus feet of Ramanujacharya. And Ramanujacharya was describing that this is the power of Mahaprasad, that which was offered to the Lord and then taken by the Lord's pure devotee. The power of Mahaprasad was inexplicable. Now, we can't imitate these activities, but it's there to give some indication of the capacity that prasadam has to completely transform consciousness of people. Maybe in your local temples or your places where you live, you have similar experience of persons who became transformed just from taking prasadam. I can tell some little local stories, but not something quite like that one. One who has faith in Chaitanya Lila, Kalidas had such faith in the Mahaprasad of the Vaishnavas that he gained the favor of Lord Chaitanya that no one could receive. You know the story from Chaitanya Charitamrita. He took a vow that he would take the Mahaprasad of every Vaishnav in all of Bengal. And at the time of Lord Chaitanya, that's a lot of Vaishnavas. It was a bigger Bengal also. It wasn't just West Bengal. So Krishnadas Kaviraj describes the story of Jadu Thakur and his going to his home and giving him a mango and asking him directly saying, please take the mango and I want the remnants of your mango. So I can't do this. You're an elevated brahmana and I'm a poor fool. It would be offense for me to even consider honoring your request. And then Kalidas gave his scriptural arguments. One who chants the holy name of the Lord is to be worshipped by everyone. You're worshipable by me and by all living entities. He didn't press, I want your Mahaprasadam remnants, but he left the home. Jadu Thakur was very happy. He gave the mango to his wife to offer to the deity. She offered to the deity, gave the mango to her husband. He ate part of it and left part of it for her. She accepted his remnants and then took the leaf plate and the pit of the mango and discarded in the discard pile, the natural compost pile, as we say in the West. And Kalidas went there and licked up the leaf plate and sucked on the mango pit and felt surcharged with spiritual happiness taking the prasad of Jadu Thakur. And in this way, Kaviraj Goswami says, he visited the home of all Vaishnavas in all of Bengal because of his great faith in the prasad of Vaishnavas. So much pleased was Lord Chaitanya, not that he was keeping a scorecard and how many homes did he visit, but rather his faith in Mahaprasad. So that one time when Lord Chaitanya was entering into the Jagannath temple, there was a very strict rule that when he was washing his feet before entering the temple, no one was to touch the water. But Kalidas put his hands out like this to catch the water. And Lord Chaitanya allowed him. 3 times he took the water, and he reached the 4th time, and Lord Chaitanya said, Kalidas, enough is enough. Stop. But he didn't disallow it. He consciously allowed it. And then we saw in Gambhira, the little tiny space and the little windows, and one time Lord Chaitanya was taking prasad brought by Govinda, Jagannath prasad, and Kalidas was looking in the window. Lord Chaitanya pointed, there's Kalidas, he wants Mahaprasad remnants, give him the whole plate. Because of his great faith in Mahaprasadam. So there are ways to honor prasadam and ways to not. There's one other quote that I'm thinking to not read, but I'll read it. He's speaking about editing. Yeah. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati insisted that all published articles be freed from spelling mistakes and would reprimand the disciples responsible if he noticed any. He similarly scrutinized statements and creeds to detect and expose the minutest defects, the basis of each being the same, namely, antagonism towards acceptance of Sri Krishna's supreme overlordship. He declared, I don't read the book, I read the author. I first check whether the author is authentic. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur trained me in proofreading, so I always look for what is right or wrong. I am not a proofreader of the press only, I am a proofreader of the world. I proofread men. I proofread religions. I dissect their faults and try to correct them. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur ki jai. Any thoughts or comments or questions? Yes. Hear the question?
Yeah.
In the back, he's saying, Jagannath Ballab Gardens, Gambhira, we have this spiritual experience. For myself, the impression is not as strong as it should be. On the other hand, some thought or some experience of sense gratification, immediately the heart goes there and it's a very strong experience and it endures. So why this other one is so weak and it's not enduring? Someone else asked a similar question at Jagannath Ballabh Garden. Not the same, but similar. We're conditioned souls, and we have material coverings called mind and intelligence and false ego. And the mind is reading the impressions of the senses, I like, I don't like. And it's the basis is selfishness and sense gratification. And that's the contaminated state. It's not the natural state, but that's the present circumstance that we're dealing with. So these very sacred places, highly sacred places, it's not that there's not having any effect. It's having a spiritual effect. And that spiritual effect is like, you know, a deposit in your eternal bank account. There's no diminution of that, no matter what happens in the material sphere. So the main concern should be open your receivers as far as possible. And, you know, your receiving capacity may be, you know, a whole range, like, you know, from practically nil to a little bit, but hardly anything, and so on. Whatever it is that we can consciously, in the present moment, perceive, that will encourage us in our devotional service. Even if that's like way down there on the scale, hardly showing any sign of anything, the spiritual benefit nonetheless is there. To the degree that we are able to hear, then the hearing will be enriched by our being in the Dham and being in the Kirtan and being in the association of devotees, and the hearing will be strengthened. And so it's primarily through hearing, not simply just by being, because there are other creatures, insects and birds and trees and dogs and other entities. Because they're Dhamvasis, they're greatly fortunate too. But their capacity for hearing is not the same as the human form of life. Hearing and understanding and awakening of God consciousness. So trying to maximize our capacity with our human form of life and hearing spiritual sound vibrations from proper sources in that all auspicious spiritual atmosphere, that's the maximize the receiving part. So put your attention there and don't worry, like, you know, is it here or here or here or it's not there. And it's a cultivation of Krishna consciousness, and according to our capacity, we're cultivating Krishna consciousness. And as much as you can, not just intellectually understand, but as much as you can receive that sound vibration of the glories of the great devotees, or the glories of the place, or the pastimes, exchanges of love, the exhibitions of Krishna consciousness that Lord Chaitanya exhibited in those places, that's going to make an indelible impression. Later on, as one becomes more advanced, that impression will be restored and will be, you know, nurtured by a more advanced state of Krishna consciousness. You can take it like, you know, a small child, when the small child is still in the womb of the mother. What cognizance does the living entity in the womb of the mother have? But spiritual benefit, we know, is going. And we see the effect when proper care is given, and so on and so on and so on. So same for ourselves, as, like, you know, if our body is an adult body, it's, you know, from the platform of the soul, it doesn't change at all. The platform of the mind and the senses does change, and the body. But the by the hearing process, best to by acceptance with faith, with evaluation, faith combined with good reason, accept the process that will purify, and gradually the capacity will grow. The capacity to recognize, wow, and you know, experience and feel transcendental reality. And we can only work with what we have to work with. We're very conditioned souls. That's our state. You know, what you said is very similar to what the joke that Madhavananda said. We have two mantras, one that can put devotees to sleep and one that can wake them up. Or in the Amona Durmati song that Shruti sang today, you know, my happiness is when other people are suffering, I derive unlimited happiness. Oh, wicked mind. When there's some opportunity for sense gratification, we wake up. We're very active, we're very animated. Because our attraction for Krishna is so weak. If there's someone that you hold very dear, you may be very tired or whatever. That person comes and all of a sudden you're animated and you're happy and you're, you know, all that tiredness is gone. Our attraction for Krishna is weak. That's why. Attraction for transcendental... There's something that's there, otherwise we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. But it's weak. Our conditioning is strong. And that's just our situation. From that situation you act in Krishna consciousness. You act as far as possible in your relationship with Guru and Krishna and receive from them as far as you can by proper standards and proper practices, and Krishna's assurance is there. One who strives by right means is assured of success. So we continue moving with faith. Is that something? Well, it's not that humility shouldn't be shown to everyone, but how we exhibit humility should be appropriate for the person. His point was, it's like, you know, Arjuna. Arjuna was Arjuna absent or devoid of humility? Or he was devoid of humility before when he wanted to leave the battlefield, and when he became convinced by Krishna's words, he lost his humility? Humility doesn't just mean turn the other cheek. Humility means you think of yourself with the proper concept that you're spirit soul, you're Krishna's part and parcel. Before Krishna, you're very tiny. Now what does Krishna want? And whatever Krishna wants, that's what you want. And you do that for Krishna. So Krishna wanted Arjuna to fight, so he fought. He didn't like lose his humility. What Hanuman was doing was in service to Ram. He wasn't devoid of humility. But he was exhibiting appropriate for the situation or the personalities, his position as the servant of Ram. That's true humility. Appropriate for the circumstance, for the pleasure of Krishna. Not, you know, what my sensibility is. And one of the sections I didn't read is Bhaktisiddhanta's strong dislike for vox populi, or people taking what is morality or what is religion or what is to be done based on a whole lot of people say it, so that's what it is. And you know, by so doing, immediately Godhead just disappears. There's no real authority other than what a lot of people say. So the other way around, if one takes, one has genuine humility, there's one thing that's important to me. My relationship with Krishna, my master. I'm his menial servant, whatever he wants. That's what I want. That's humility. Anything else? Yes. They're louder than you are. 9:30. Yeah. No. No. That's not what it means. Want to try again? I'm trying to understand your question. You're trying to understand my answer. Anya means other, and ananya means no other. Undivided bhakti. Ananya, nothing but bhakti. So someone's going along in life and it's bhakti and bhakti and bhakti and bhakti, and here comes a tsunami and they get flattened. They didn't stop being a bhakta, they just got flattened. And the tsunami recedes and now it's bhakti and bhakti and bhakti. Such a person is sadhu, in Krishna's opinion. That's ananya bhakti. Doesn't worry. Why mix in the pure devotee thing? It's just undivided devotion. Undivided devotion. Bhakti, it means the satisfaction of Krishna is the objective of my life. Undivided. There's nothing other than my devotion to Krishna in my life. You can say pure devotion. That brings up so many ISKCONisms, in my opinion, by the nature of the question. So it's just undivided devotion. You know, who's a pure devotee kind of thing. Undivided devotion. And by circumstance, not by paucity of devotion, but by circumstance, the circumstance becomes overwhelming. That may happen. Krishna is indicating it may happen. Even in the case of someone who is an undeviated devotee, undeviated in their determination. You could say pure devotee, but ananya bhakti. Yes, yes. The example, the tsunami example that I gave is similar to what the example that Prabhupada gives is the tide comes in and the tide goes out. The tide goes in and there's a line and it doesn't change. So there's some ebbs and flows of life, but there may be some extraordinary circumstances of life that arise and just overwhelm everybody, including an ananya bhakta. And in that overwhelming circumstantial situation, that bhakta engages in something very bad. That's what Krishna is describing. Circumstantially, something very bad. Not only ordinarily, but, you know, without exception, undividedly. Their condition is fixed in devotion. And such a person, apichet means even if it's like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur calls it hypothesis, hypothetical. You know, supposing the moon falls into the ocean. Now, it's not going to fall into the ocean. But supposing the moon fell into the ocean, what would happen if the moon fell into the ocean? Well, even if the moon fell into the ocean, even that which would never happen, happens. Even if. So ordinarily, it doesn't happen. But circumstantially, it may happen. Okay? Anything else? Okay, sorry. Yeah.
You were mentioning Srila Bhakti Saraswati's instructions to his commentary disciples, how one should be preaching, one should be exemplary representative of Bhakti.
Yeah.
So, and because people are evaluating you, they're always evaluating you, and therefore they're evaluating the movement.
That was my embellishment, but yes. His point is different. His point is, one who does that will be then given impetus to come to that standard. It's good for them to do that, even if they're not at that standard, because it will give them impetus to come to that standard. It will be purifying for them, even if they're not at that standard. But they want to come to that standard because they're representing. It helps one become chaste. And otherwise you just don't do that, and you know, it's status quo. It's everything stays the same. That same impetus for purification isn't there. Don't stay home. Oh, I'm not pure character yet. I can't go and preach. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.